Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And what's going on? The World Health Organization today raised its alert level for the second time in 3 days to the number 5, one notch below 6, which indicates full-scale global pandemic. Yesterday, the WHO said that today's move was imminent. Why the change? We know cases have been confirmed on 4 continents. Countries like France are debating banning flights to Mexico, where there have been 168 suspected swine flu deaths. But it's hard to see that the world is one step from pandemic. Matt McGraw is science correspondent for the BBC. He's in London. Matt, do you have a sense of how we've gone from a pandemic alert 4 to 5 in one day?
Yes, Robin, I guess I do. I mean, on Monday we were at 3 and now we're at 5. I've just been listening to the World Health Organization give some explanation as to what their thinking is behind this. And they are making this decision on their strictly legal decision. I mean, you have to understand this is a medical organization. They're taking decisions based on what they see in the data. And their view on this is that if you have in one region of the world, two countries where people are transmitting the virus from themselves to other people, and it's acquiring community transmission, then you have a situation where they go to level 5. And that's what they believe is happening in Mexico and the United States. They point to what's happened in New York, and they point to the situation in Canada and in Mexico, and they say taking the data all together, looking at the picture and taking scientific advice and doing some computer modeling as to how this virus is spreading, they feel it's the right thing right now to go to level 5 and get people ahead of the game, if you like.
Well, some people are wondering, are they also, you spoke of the modeling, is the WHO maybe seeing something others aren't? For instance, people have been wondering, why aren't there more cases suspected in Central America, you know, neighboring Mexico? And some have wondered whether maybe the WHO is suspecting some deaths, or maybe there's a suspicion that countries that don't yet have the equipment to detect whether deaths are swine flu, you know, maybe those deaths are going to start showing up.
I think there are two separate issues there, really. One is about the number of confirmed cases of the actual new virus. The other is about the number of deaths related to it. Now, today, the WHO is saying that in the world as a whole, they have confirmed 236 cases. That's up from about 148 cases yesterday. They've confirmed about 97 of the Mexican cases. But when it comes to the number of people who've died in Mexico, they're still stuck on the number 7. They have confirmed 7 deaths so far have come from this virus. So there's quite a discrepancy in these figures from the number of people who have died and the Mexican government are saying have died from this virus and the number of people whom the WHO have proved have died from this virus.
Right.
So these figures are a bit confusing, I understand, but they do in some respects indicate that the virus is spreading, but it's not killing very many people so far.
So thank you, because you've separated out two separate issues, deaths and then the spread of suspected illness. But staying with these, you know, tragic deaths, they are still all, as far as we can see, Mexicans. Even the toddler who had crossed into the United States, he was Mexican. And so many are asking, is there something that the WHO is looking at as to why Mexicans are dying from this disease and others are only getting sick?
There are a number of different factors that could be at play here. One is that the people who caught this virus may not have gone for attention early enough. They may not have had the information. They may not have had the facilities in their area. It could be issues in nutrition. There could be pre-existing conditions that people could have been suffering. They could have been immunologically compromised with TB or some other ailment. So there are a number of different factors that could be at play here that may not be at play in other parts of the world. You know, the people who travel to Mexico, let's face it, have probably been more affluent than some of the people in Mexico. They have access to possibly better healthcare, and they have possibly better knowledge and greater awareness of what's going on. So people, when they've come back from Mexico, have had a sniffle, they've gone to their doctors, and they've been treated straight away with antiviral drugs. People in Mexico who weren't aware of this situation, when we didn't know this was a possible pandemic, possibly sat around hoping to get better, and that in some cases never happened.
Right. Well, and speak to reports we're hearing that there's suspicion that this swine flu may have been around for a year.
Yeah, there's a number of different theories on this, aren't there, in terms of where it originated from and how it originated. I mean, I spoke to one scientist yesterday. He said it could have been through 3, 4, 5 years ago. It could have happened when we had something that transmitted itself through a pig and then maybe moved on to a human being. So there's a team from the UN going down to Mexico in the next couple of days, and they're going to look at the sites where this is supposed to have happened, and they're going to trying to get some data. They're going to spend 2 weeks gathering that data. So I think we will at some stage get a view as to how it all happened. But right now, I think think the authorities are more concerned realistically about where it's going rather than where it came from.
Matt McGrath, science correspondent for the BBC. We keep grappling with this, but just one last question. Is there a sense of when we go to six?
Yeah, a scientist I spoke to yesterday suggested that it could happen within a week. I mean, the WHO today were very clear. There was nothing that they saw today in their data that gave any indication that they should move above five. So it's not inevitable. They say it's imminent, but not inevitable. So we will have to wait and see how things transpire over the next 4 or 5 days.
Matt McGrath, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Well, Mexican President Felipe Calderon today said that only essential businesses such as supermarkets and hospitals should remain open, as we said, the number of suspicious deaths in Mexico is 168. But the confirmed deaths from the drug wars may exceed 10,000 in the 3 years since the Mexican government launched a crackdown on the drug cartels. Just this week, 7 policemen were assassinated in Tijuana. The drug cartels hire hitmen to do their killing. They often work for the state police and the cartels at the same time. And one who was paid as much as $20,000 per job told his story to our next guest. That's journalist Charles Bowden. After years of covering the Mexican drug wars, he says he's comfortable around killers. He once partied with 200 of them in a Mexican hotel for 5 days. But they were not interested in talking about their murders. This hitman was, which puts both of them in danger. The hitman was one of the sicarios, that's Latin for dagger, and Chuck's interview with him appears in the May issue of Harper's. Chuck Bowden joins us from WWNO in New Orleans. Chuck, welcome back to Here and Now.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here and be alive.
Yeah, I would think so. A lot of what we're going to hear is graphic, and your article was written in a very almost Raymond Chandler style, you know, as you wait for the call that directs you to this interview. So just one quick question first about the writing. Do you ever worry about how, in trying to get across this depravity that you've been witnessing for years now, you're romanticizing it? Or are you trying to strip it bare to reveal it?
Look, if I wrote that story any flatter, it'd look like Kansas.
Yeah.
That I just wrote down what he said and what he did. And if you think that's romance, I don't want to date with you. You can make the argument that any time you write reality without any defense, you're writing a kind of pornography. I don't agree with it, and I'll give you an example. In 2008, 1,607 human beings were slaughtered in the city of Juarez. During that same period, only 18 people died in neighboring El Paso. A lot of the killing is done by men exactly like the sicario, the killer, in this piece. And I think it's time we smell the coffee and face reality.
Yeah.
The second thing I wanted to convey in that piece was this wasn't a mafia guy or something. This guy was a state policeman trained by the U.S. FBI and a comandante in the state police in the state of Chihuahua. He represents the reality that American politicians who are brain like jackasses now about fixing Mexico won't face. That there is no war in any real sense between the government of Mexico and the drug people. It's a seamless web of an industry that supplies the United States with a bunch of chemicals that make us happy in the evening. What he is a jolt of reality.
Yeah.
The barbarism in the piece, I can neither apologize for or get away from. This is the life. The police come. They take you. You're taken to a place and tortured for days, weeks, or months. You're eventually murdered. You're put in a secret grave. Nobody ever knows what happens to you. This guy did that for 19 years. He is not a freak. He is the way things operate. Now
well,
be calm.
Well, let's get to it. The story of how he becomes a part of this police infrastructure is astonishing. He's a teen, he's enlisted, and he soon finds himself, as you said, driving police cars and carrying out kidnappings. He was sent to an FBI school?
Yes, in the United States. We trained him. He told me the training was very good. I said, what did they train you in? He said, how to find stolen cars, how to find drugs, and how to detect guns, which, of course, were all things he was doing.
Right. They were supplied, the cadets at the police academy, he says, supplied with liquor, drugs, women. But tell us just a little bit, an anecdote of, you know, how the police would work to carry out the ransom kidnappings.
I should mention this guy was in charge of the anti-kidnapping squad in Ciudad Juarez at one point.
Let's be clear, the anti-kidnapping squad.
The anti. He would get a call from a superior whom he never knew, be told the assignment. He would then go pick up the person, you know, as a state policeman. They would then be taken to a secret house. They would then be tortured. Their family would then pay a fortune to get them back. Meanwhile, he told me in 98% of the cases he worked on, you killed the person almost immediately. Then you get the money. Often the families would call saying that their loved one was missing, and they would be calling the very people that took their loved one, the state police. He was paid by the state government of Chihuahua, but his real money and everybody he worked with came from a bank account in El Paso. They got a monthly check. He assumed that was from the cartel. But one of the facts of this life is you never ask questions, meaning the life he was in. In fact, he does this for 18 or 19 years, and by the end, he never knows which cartel he actually worked for.
Right.
And this is a guy who was issued his own plane and his own pilot so he could fly around the country doing killings.
Yeah.
He had a set of uniforms, so he was the proper agency wherever he landed. He would land and be given police cars from that jurisdiction. This is the face of the state.
Yeah.
And by state, I mean government.
You have mentioned several times torture. Again, this is very graphic. This won't be for every listener. But it's important to hear, I think, that we're not talking about somebody yelling at someone.
His victims would have been happy to be waterboarded. You know, we're talking about, I pour fuel on your T-shirt. I light the petroleum on your T-shirt. I carefully monitor it so it just burns a hide off your back. I have a doctor there in case you pass out, because it'd be no fun torturing you if you're unconscious, who injects you to keep you awake. There's one scene in the piece involving two DEA informants where he does this for 3 days and three nights. And then they finally manage to die before they can go into the fourth day.
For a while, you write, the organization that he was working for would offer Colombian neckties. This is the throat being cut and the tongue pulled through the slit.
Well, it's cut the throat and slip the tongue through it. They also, because, you know, they get television, they saw necklacing in South Africa. I put a tire around your neck and then light it, burn your head off. They were doing that for a while in the 90s. He told me the trick in torturing is to not overdo it, because if you overdo it, people become insensitive to pain.
Chuck, are you sure? I mean, are you convinced that everything he was saying was true and not bravado?
Yeah, I'm certain to start with. Unlike the listeners here, I had the advantage of being with him. He's actually a rather unassuming person. The second thing is, I checked him out. In fact, I have a close Mexican friend who knows the mentor of this killer.
That's Chuck Boden. His story about this killer who committed murder for the drug cartels is in the May issue of Harper's. When we come back, how both the hitman and the journalist try to leave the violence behind. And later today, tomorrow's the deadline to send in deposits for college, but it's not too late to negotiate more financial aid. Have you let a school know if you've lost your job or if you're getting a better financial aid package elsewhere? We're going to have some tips later today, but we'll be back in a minute with Chuck here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with Chuck Boden, who, after an elaborate dance, landed an interview in Juarez, Mexico, with a hitman, a man who kidnapped, tortured, and killed for the drug cartels, a trade he learned while working for the Mexican State Police. Now this man has found God and wants to talk. His story is in the May issue of Harper's. And Chuck, before the break, you said you believed him because you have 20 years reporting on these stories of the drug violence in Mexico. You've seen the carnage on the other end. You've seen the effects of his work.
Well, yeah, it's horrifying.
Yeah.
I've been at three death houses, and I should explain to the listeners, a death house is a house you're taken to after you're abducted, then you're tortured and killed and buried in the yard. One had 12 corpses, one had 9, one had 36 corpses. And when I asked the subject, the sicario or killer, he said there were hundreds of them in the city. He told me he'd personally dug 250 graves in the city and he could lead me to 600 bodies. And he also told me he had no idea how many people were like him. that he knew he was just in a cell. He was one little part of an organism, that he knew, had no idea who he worked for. He didn't know how anything really operated. He was not a big guy. What he was extremely intelligent. That before he met me, which took a lot of, let's just say, negotiation, I'd go there and he didn't show up, he finally shows up and he's got 10 pages, single space, to print out from the internet about me. And he slaps it down on the table. And, of course, I relax then because, one, because mainly I realized the guy was really intelligent. But what he was telling me was, if you welch on me, if you, you know, turn me in, I know how to find you. So that was the way we began, oddly enough, kind of relaxed.
Well, you know, it's sort of the
way...
It got
a little worse after that.
Well, I was going to say, it's sort of the way you left, too, because this is a man who tells you one of the reasons he's talking to you is that somewhere along the way, he got God. But as he said, I have God. God frees me, you know, to speak to you, but I remain a wolf. I can't become a lamb. And as you part, you pray when you part. You hug each other and pray, but then you notice he does something as you're both walking away.
He would meet me, and then we'd drive around. He'd just point to a motel, and I'd go in and rent a room. And when we leave, I'm going walking through the parking lot after we've had this prayer, which I must say I believe was sincere. I could feel almost vibrations coming through him as he prayed because he had his arm around me. I notice him automatically memorizing my license plate on my car, and that's the part where he's a wolf. He can't turn it off. There's a $250,000 contract on his head.
Why is that? Why is that? Oh, from
one of the cartels. Because he offended the son of a boss. And so he's a dead man walking. He knows they will find him. He was one of them. The final thing you have to know about him is he'll be very hard to kill because he's a killer. You know, he could take on an army with a fountain pen. He's a professional. As this guy told me, he discovered one day that he'd spent almost 20 years working for Satan. Now he's, you know, trying not to kill. He's trying to have a straight life, get up, go to work, etc. But he knows in his heart he's killed too many people, that eventually he will be murdered. That's the cross that he's crucified on.
Why did he become what he is? You say he says it was a way to live, that he's not a victim of poverty, even though it sounds as if, you know, he was a family of 12 kids.
No,
why?
Okay, I'll tell you what he thinks. He got through high school by being in a gang, and the gang ran drugs into El Paso for the cartel. And then he gets out of high school and starts college and can't afford it. The state police come to him and recruit him, basically to be part of their criminal organization. Once he gets in, he has to kill. His first killing he was ordered to do, and when he did it, the state police said, "You have passed the test." Then he discovered he had a capacity for it. Now, he says a lot of what happened to him he can't remember because the way he kept on killing was a healthy diet of Jack Daniels and cocaine for about 15 or 20 years. But what I found is when I got down to specifics, if he'd tell me he couldn't remember something and I went back to it, he remembered everything. And he actually wanted the story published because in his eyes, it's an act of redemption. And the redemption is, if it's published, other people that are doing what he's doing will think they can leave too. My goal was to get this on paper. If we're going to have a policy toward Mexico, we should have a reality of what's going on there. I'll give you an example. Every month or two, if you read the Mexican press, you find out some key official close to the president of Mexico has been found to work for a cartel. But you never read a story where the government of Mexico has a key source next to a cartel. The other thing you should notice in this war, where 10,000 people have died since December of 2006, very few soldiers have been killed. A lot of Mexicans have died, but it's a very odd war. You have a bunch of trained killers like the Sicario, but the soldiers seem immune. What I'm suggesting is you'll never understand what's going on there if you think it's a war against drugs. It's a war for drugs.
That's Chuck Bowden. Chuck, by the way, you talk about how the hired killer that you spoke to he had a cross to bear. What about yours? You have published two books on this. In 95, when you were writing, murders were about 200 to 300 a year. In 2008, as you said, they're up to 1,607 Mexicans killed. You write, you are a prisoner of all this killing.
I'm trying to escape. Now, I'm bringing out a book next year on this war of violence with more on the Sicario. But that's my farewell note. I'm in New Orleans and my life is étouffée and gumbo.
Chuck Boden, do you have a name for the forthcoming book, Chuck?
Miss Sinaloa.
Miss Sinaloa.
Miss Sinaloa was a beauty queen who went to Juarez to party with the police and was gang raped for 3 days. And then she went insane.
All right. That's the title of his forthcoming book. His latest book is Some of the Dead Are Still Breathing. And his story, The Sicario, A Juarez Hitman Speaks, is in the May issue of Harper's. And Chuck is speaking to us from New Orleans. Thanks so much, Chuck.
Thank you.
Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, it's the first jewel in horse racing's Triple Crown and the first running of the Kentucky Derby since a horse died last year. We'll speak with writer Joe Drape. That's tomorrow. Be back after the latest news here and now. Two new studies published today in the journal Nature say that current goals of cutting carbon dioxide emissions are a good start, but nowhere near enough to keep global warming from increasing to an agreed-upon danger level. And the U.S. will have to increase its goals from cutting 80% of pollution to cutting 90-95% to keep the world from exceeding the danger level in just 20 years. Well, Tom Friedman says there is one solution.
What I've really been trying to do is to redefine green. If only half the country identifies with green and the other half thinks it's a pejorative, we're really going nowhere.
Author and New York Times columnist Tom Friedman was at Boston's Museum of Science this week to receive their Washburn Award for his writing on the environment. And we asked him about his goal to get everyone on board on taxes on coal, oil, natural gas.
Well, ultimately, we have to have a carbon tax. When gasoline was $4.50 a gallon, you couldn't buy a Toyota Prius. When gasoline is $1.50 a gallon, you can't sell a Toyota Prius. Price matters. And if you do not put a price on carbon that will stimulate the innovation you need and the consumers you need, it's just not going to happen.
You say this is sort of the only question right now.
I think it is. I think the price issue is the only question. You know, Bob Lutz, the vice chairman of GM, made a good point the other day. He said, look, you know, the Congress is telling General Motors, car companies in Detroit, make smaller, lighter, more fuel-efficient cars. Great. But then they say, oh, gasoline tax? Oh, no, we can't do that, Congress says. So when Mr. Lutz said, well, that's like the government ordering every shirt maker in America to only make size smalls, but never asking the American people to go on a diet? Yeah, you're not going to sell a lot of size smalls.
So he's asking also, as you are, that President Obama have a gas tax?
Well, a gas tax, a carbon tax would cover that as well. But we're going to have some kind of price signal. If we don't, we'll get change. We'll get it at the margins, the kind of thing you'd get if you had a hobby, a green hobby. I like hobbies. I used to build model airplanes as a kid. I don't try to change the climate as a hobby.
The cap and trade, some sort of tax on emissions. We talked to a mayor on the program who realizes he's got empty factories in his town from industries that have folded. He's got out-of-work steel workers. Hey, if he could get the factories going again, he could have the steel workers building wind turbines. But he's got to get the factory owners to understand that they've got to do something about their emissions first. How do you get the American workers who aren't already to understand they need to push for things like this to get their factories back?
Well, it's a leadership question. Somebody's got to frame the issue for the American public, educate them about the connections, that if you do have a carbon tax, what will it do? That is precisely what will stimulate 10,000 green innovators in 10,000 garages to try 10,000 things, 1,000 of which will be promising, 100 of which will be way cool, and 2 of which will be the next green Google and green Microsoft. That's how it happens. I'm at this stage for any price signal you can get. Cap and trade, the kind of system you're talking about, carbon tax, fee baits, gasoline tax.
So how does a President Obama do that? You had a saying about changing leaders.
Yeah, my saying is change your leaders, not your light bulbs. And as you said, we have changed our leaders. We've got President Obama, and he's off to an amazing start. The EPA, his Environmental Protection Agency, has ruled that CO2, a greenhouse gas, is a pollutant, needs to be controlled. He's appointed an amazing group of scientists and environmentalists to run his policy. And the stimulus bill has all kinds of wonderful stuff for promoting energy efficiency. But without that price signal, you will not get change at scale.
And how does he, where's the disconnect?
The disconnect is that no one wants to make the transition, okay? Because everyone would rather just say, oh, gas went up to $4.50, Robin. That's not me. That's the market. I got no control. Of course, when we let the market do it, what happens? All the money goes to coal and oil companies and petrodictators, okay? What it needs is a leader who comes in and says, we keep postponing the transition. We're not going to do that anymore. There's going to be a price on carbon, just like there's a price on cigarettes, okay? There's going to be a price on carbon. It's going to hurt in the transition, but we're going to make this transition because on the other side is a permanent carbon tax cut. Why? Because, yes, the price of your kilowatt hour will go up individual hour. The price of your average gallon of gasoline will go up. But this price signal will stimulate the very innovation and consumer demand for more efficient cars, more efficient homes, more efficient lights, more efficient appliances. That is a carbon tax cut. It's waiting for us on the other side of this transition. And it's the gift that keeps on giving.
Tom Friedman, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Tom Friedman at Boston's Museum of Science earlier this week. Back in half a minute, here and now. Tuition deposits are due at many colleges tomorrow, May 1st, and many students and families are still trying to make last-minute decisions. Well, we may have some help for you. Gail Marks Jarvis is personal finance columnist for the Chicago Tribune. She joins us from Chicago Public Radio. And Gail, this is always a pretty stressful time as families try to figure out what they can afford. But what are you hearing from families this year?
This is very different from other years. Families are so financially stressed right now and so nervous. First of all, even if they have the ability to pay for college right now, they're worried they could lose their jobs, so they're afraid to make the commitment. But a lot of families have lost jobs. A lot of families have lost 30% of their money in some of the college savings plans that are available through states. And their homes aren't worth what they were, so they can't do the home equity loans that they usually do.
Right. And so they're struggling. Just give us some overarching tips of what students and families should be doing right now if they are in this, you know, haven't made a decision.
This is the most important thing, and this is what families usually do not do. They usually set their minds on a particular school, and the family's saying, can we afford it? Can we not afford it? And what they have to do is they have to say, things might be okay if I choose another school. That gives you then the freedom to negotiate.
Right. Get some offers from other schools and see what they're offering and go back to the school.
Exactly that. Families don't realize they can negotiate for financial aid. And so what they're doing is they're just taking a knee-jerk reaction and they're saying, I can't afford it. You can't go to school this year. And because of that, colleges are totally fretting because they don't know if they can count on the students to be there. And that means it's time to play Let's Make a Deal.
Well, and by the way, you talk about parents who might be saying to their children, we think you might have to sit out for a year. Just heartbreaking, you know, but if the finances have changed. And you say, look for financial aid first. Don't sit out a year. Why?
Well, what people don't realize is they think that if they sit out a year, they can save, the student can work and save money, and that'll make college more affordable. In fact, it can work just the opposite, because if you have a financial aid package and you're eligible for a financial aid package, if the student goes to work, that will cut your aid down. So it might actually cost them more next year than it would this year to send the child to college.
And by the way, what if the situation has changed drastically because parents have lost jobs, which has happened to so many people? It's not too late to let the college know that your financial status has changed, you say.
No, absolutely not. In fact, May 1st is the deadline for many colleges, but don't let that get in your way. What I'm hearing when I'm talking to different people in the college admissions process, they are expecting to be admitting students all the way past opening day of school next fall.
Huh.
And the reason is because so many people's finances are up in the air. They're leaving one college, going to another. So don't take that May 1st deadline as an absolutely critical endpoint.
And make sure that financial aid officers have that most recent information if your job status has changed, because otherwise, how do they know? They're going off your finances from when you had a job.
You have to go to them. Sometimes you have to show information that shows that you did indeed lose your job. And they may ask you to file what's called an appeal. And that's usually a letter about what's happened.
And by the way, in one of your columns, you write, the Department of Education just sent a letter to financial aid offices telling them that they can base federal grants, Pell Grants, for instance, this is money you don't have to pay back, on a person's current and likely employment over the next 12 months instead of the past. So again, if you've just lost your job and you think you'll be out of work for a year, go back for financial aid.
You should, and if you find another college that is willing to give you thousands of dollars more, you can go back to the college of your dreams and say, this other college is helping me out a lot, and I'm having a hard time making a case to go to your school, even though that is the college of my dreams. Can you try to give me what this other college is doing? And usually the colleges try to work with you.
Well, but you also write, if they don't, you could still get a very good deal from another school and you could take it. One student going to Middlebury in Vermont, expensive school, she came from a fairly affluent family. The college said no to any more financial aid, but she transferred to Rice and got a huge financial aid package, and that was worth it to her.
That's true, and that particular student was not eager to do this. That student had already gone to Middlebury for 2 years, and she was very immersed in the school. But her father and mother said to her, we just can't swing this anymore. This is going to kill our retirement. So the family said to this girl, we're going to go back and ask for more financial aid. And Middlebury said no. So the student applied to Rice and got thousands of dollars in financial aid.
You also say if you don't have the college of your dreams lined up, don't be afraid of a couple years at community college. Some of them are just, you know, they're terrific. But on the other hand, don't assume you're going to get into community colleges because so many students are turning to them.
This is another thing people need to be aware of. Often people that are short on cash say, I'm going to apply to a community college or I'm going to apply to a public school that's right down the road. It'll be my cheapest option. That's not always the case. And in the current environment, public universities are very strapped and they're getting a lot of applications because so many people are thinking that's my cheap alternative. Remember this. Many of the less known private colleges might be where you can get your best financing because those are the schools that people think are unaffordable, and so families are turning away without realizing that they might be able to get financial aid there.
Okay, you also say, don't hesitate to apply because colleges are so afraid that they'll have openings, that they're taking more students than they can accommodate. Now, they may take you, but you may have to do study abroad, or you may have to live in an apartment off campus, but still, take that shot there. But also, you write, families can calculate what they can afford to pay for college. It's called Expected Family Contribution. We'll link you to an online calculator at our website, hereandnow.org. But we're also reading that increasingly colleges are asking parents to pay more than they can afford. This is called gapping. Tell us more about that.
Okay. Colleges have you fill out a form called a FAFSA so they can calculate what they think you can afford to pay for college. Let's say that you apply to a college that costs $20,000 a year, but when you fill out the FAFSA shows that your family can only afford to pay $10,000 a year. The very best colleges that have a lot of resources will allow you to go to that college and pay just $10,000 a year. They will come up with the additional $10,000, and it'll come in different forms. The best form is grants. That's free money you don't have to pay. Mm-hmm. But in addition to grants, they'll give you perhaps a work-study job. And in addition to that, they'll allow you to get federal low-interest loans at probably a 6% interest rate. In the situation where there's what you call the gap, these are colleges that are really strapped for money now, and they might not be able to pay the full $10,000 for you. And so they say, even though you can only afford to pay $10,000 to come to our school, we'll let you in, but you're going to have to pay $13,000, and you have to figure out how to come up with the extra $3,000.
Okay, but it's still less than the $20,000, so that might be worth it to you.
It might be. And yeah. What families should know is that if parents have good credit, they can apply for loans at about an 8% interest rate. And with those loans, the parents can borrow 100% of what the student needs for college. And I point this out because what the family should not do is go to a bank and get a private loan that's going to cost about 12% in interest.
Go with the 8%. Gail Marks Jarvis, personal finance columnist for the Chicago Tribune, speaking to us from Chicago Public Radio. Gail, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And by the way, if you'd like to listen to this or any other story on the program, just go to our website, hereandnow.org, or download a podcast. Good luck to everyone heading off to college. We'll be back in a minute, Here and Now. Welcome back to Here and Now.
And now, the moment you have all been waiting for, all the way from New York City, the Broadway cast of Hair!
It's hard to get an entire Broadway cast to come to you, but earlier this week, all of the actors from the highly acclaimed revival of Hair came to perform at a gala benefit for the American Repertory Theater here in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And it's safe to say they did so because of Diane Paulus, who brought Hair to Central Park and then onto Broadway and has since moved to Cambridge to head up the American Rep Theater. Before the gala, she put her actors through their paces.
Okay, so here's the button.
Bum, bum, bum.
Diane's made quite a name for herself in theater and opera. She's taught at Columbia and Yale. Her goal is to make the community and the audience a player.
I always look for those opportunities to allow the audience to have a voice, literally, a presence, literally, a participation, literally.
Give me a real example of that.
The actors at the Hirschfeld Theater on Broadway speak directly to the audience. They actually get off the stage, come down the aisles, climb the boxes, go in the balcony. Whether you're in the seventh row orchestra or in the very last seat of the balcony at the Hirschfeld, 1,400 seats back, the actors manage to get out in the audience and make personal contact with you. And probably most symbolically, at the end of Hair, the audience is invited to actually get on the stage and dance with the cast members. So the Hirschfeld, this kind of very classic bourgeois Broadway theater, becomes a happening. It becomes a sight of a being.
But I think I remember that audiences went on the stage, you know, when it first was staged. So what do you think you did that was different?
Well, there was a tradition with Hair where audience members were asked to go on stage. And I heard about that from Jim Rado, who's one of the living authors. I don't think it's quite as large an event as we do it at the Hirschfeld. We have over 200 people on the stage. And the way Jim says it, a handful of people would get to go on stage and dance with the actors. And we really try to take the whole theater, the whole architecture of this Broadway house, and make it alive. And you see it every night. You know, every night, 1,400 people are engaged at the end of that show, on their feet, dancing, applauding, and screaming like a rock concert.
Going to do that with some of the programs that you've scheduled for the new ART season. Let's take a look. You have Shakespeare Exploded. These are three productions that are reimaginings of Shakespeare. The Donkey Show, Sleep No More, Best of Both Worlds. First of all, which are the three Shakespearean works that those are taking on, and how are you going to make it a community affair?
Well, The Donkey Show is based on A Midsummer Night's Dream, and The Donkey Show actually is set in a 1970s disco. It takes the enchanted woods of Shakespeare's Midsummer Night's Dream and resets it as 1970s Studio 54. So the audience actually is invited into a nightclub. So you're actually on the dance floor as you watch the show. Sleep No More, which is an adaptation of Shakespeare's Macbeth, is being co-produced with the ART by a group from London called Punch Drunk in a form of theater called Adventure Theater, where they take over abandoned buildings, old schools or warehouses, and they install their world of the play in this building, and every audience member gets a mask and a cape, and you wander through the building in your own space and time and experience the play.
In other words, you can make your own chronology? Or
that's right. It's almost art installation meets theater meets living video game.
Meets Halloween House.
Yes, in a way, you know, the kind of like very, very wonderful theatrics of kind of a haunted house.
Are you going to do that in this building, the ART building?
No, that will be off-site, and we have sort of several locations that we're scouting now. But that's also very symbolic that we're getting out of the building of the Loeb Drama Center and into the community.
Let's complete that cycle, the Best of Both Worlds.
Yes, the Best of Both Worlds is actually a gospel R&B musical based on A Winter's Tale, which is one of Shakespeare's late romances.
Clear the dark and empty room of anger and open wide the door.
All of the these adaptations are quite rigorously inspired by Shakespeare's plays and pay homage, in a way, to the roots of the Shakespeare play, just in the way Shakespeare was taking his ideas from other sources and stories. I'm totally interested in theater history. Actually, my obsession is truly about returning theater, not inventing it, returning theater to a moment when it was at the center of a society, where it was the center of social, religious, civic discourse.
I want to make sure we've looked at the second major cycle that you're going to be presenting, America, Boom, Bust, and Baseball. It's an adaptation of F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby, The Boom, playwright Clifford Odette's Paradise Lost, The Bust, and a new production, Red Sox Nation, about, of course, the former curse of the Red Sox. And with apologies to all our listeners outside of the Boston area, this is a Boston obsession. But how are you going to make this fresh? Because the Red Sox have been winning now for so long that it's almost like that's ancient history.
Why does God hate us? What have we done? We're down 3-0 and losing 2-1. Where's the God of mercy? This one taunts and mocks. And how do we lift the curse he has placed upon the Sox?
There's a, I think, as people here know, there's just a passionate obsession with the Red Sox and fandom. And this musical kind of celebrates the history of the Red Sox. And the show ends with the breaking of the curse, which I think is a moment everyone is willing to relive. Mm-hmm. And really, the show looks at the history of the Red Sox. They are characters like Babe Ruth in the show. And the show also looks at the integration of African Americans into baseball. And that's a great topic of American 20th century social history, which is being explored in this musical through the lens of baseball.
You got a lot of work ahead of you. Just one last question. You know, here you were, somebody who was an individual working so hard to get your vision implemented. Now, you know, you're sort of running the show. What's your life feel like now?
I've been running around as a freelance director, you know, and as a freelance director, your job is the show on the stage. But the other questions, how you produce a show, how you market it, how you reach your audience, that's really not the realm of the director. Your job is the creative art on the stage. But I've been feeling over the last few years that that's a full half of the equation. You know, it's the delivery system. And if you don't get that right, you can be great as a creative person. But if it's not brought to the people, if it's not produced correctly, then, you know, what are you putting all that effort into it for? So I'm so thrilled actually now to have an official seat at the table and have a voice in sort of larger arts policy. It's what I've been craving. For me, it's never been just about, can I do a good show? It's really, you know, can we make the theater a viable and vibrant form of culture in America?
Diane Paulus inaugurating a new era as artistic director of the American Repertory Theater here in Cambridge, Massachusetts. She's also director of Hair on Broadway. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Hello.